Got two more lessons left, two more weeks, I should say. Lessons are not in the can yet. Two lessons left, and I'm trying to figure out how to stop this off in a neat place, and I think I sort of have it figured out. Next week, we'll do something. You know, I want to just, there's subjects we haven't talked about that I want to talk about. And then I'm thinking, and this may just keep you all home, but then last week, I want to do a one-hour summary of everything we've done this year. Now, for some people, that's, I heard that before. I hate reviews. I don't know. But in one way, I'd like to have it all in 1 hour. So we just watch.
Buckle up.
Yeah, buckle up. So that's what I'm thinking about doing for the last one. And then the breakoff point for this year is we're sort of coming to the end of what will be the liberal branch, which blossoms into moralism. And next fall, I want to pick up more on the conservative side, and we haven't done anything with D.L. Moody yet. So D.L. Moody and the period we're in actually overlap, because D.L. Moody lives through the Civil War. He dies in 1899. So I think I'll start with thinking about D.L. Moody or subjects around him and then bring it forward. So I'm going to make the scene between this year and last year. And I was going to do one more checking that was kind of interesting to me. I did music here for 14 years. And then I knew everything there was about music, and I quit. I've done this now for 14 years. I don't think I'll quit. I don't know. There are days I've thought about it. So when the board says back there, where are you, Jeff? He says, Don, you're done. I'm done. And when I say I'm done, I'm done. So we're still with it. So, all right. It's been my privilege, really, for these 14 years. It's amazing how fast time has gone, and it's been a joy in my life, really, to do the teaching. And that's why I enjoyed my retirement so much, as I can actually do what I like to do. Not that I like to do the teaching so much. I like the preparation, which is kind of opposite. Gil likes to present and not like to prepare. But I like to prepare with the idea I'm going to present. But it's been wonderful to what I've learned. I mean, today is an example of starting down a path. You don't know sure where it's going to take you. You know, I've told you so many times I'm not a scholar in any sense of the word, and certainly not in the sense of the word that I know all about a subject, then I teach it. It's like I address a subject, and then I learn about it, and then I teach it. And I got that advice from a college professor one time. He told me, Don, you got to write a book. And I said, I don't know anything to write a book about, so that's why you need to write a book. Because when you're done writing the book, you'll know something about the subject. And that has really been true. So, and Gil's always suggested to me, he said, well, you know a lot more than anybody else will. I know what I don't know sometimes. I really do know what I don't know. And still, you got to go ahead. So you worry about making mistakes, but you will know a lot more than most people do because they've not studied it at all. So that's been my hope, that you're not ahead of me too far. And if you are ahead of me, you're very, very gracious and point out errors to me after class. So what's interesting about this lesson, I mean, where we are today is not where I expected it to go. I thought we would probably deal with the Civil War because it's a happening in the 19th century, midway through the 19th century, but I didn't realize the impact of the awakenings had on that. So I may make some enemies tonight. Just don't make them long-lasting. Get over it real quick. And if I made a mistake or I said something wrong or anything, anytime you're going to deal with the issue of slavery these days, you can never win. So we're going to close the doors and turn off the tape recorder, and I'm going to say what I'm going to say because I think that's what's right. I'm not saying it is right, but what seems right to me. Anyway, so the Second Great Awakening is the threshold into the Civil War, and I want to talk about that through the avenue of moralism, which is a word up there we'll spend some time on tonight explaining what that is exactly. Hopefully you'll have a little better idea if you don't already. All right, so this is our third last time we'll see that panel. I'm really tired of it, really. I've seen it so many times. It never changes. It's always stayed the same. So we're up to number 7. And we are following the bottom branch of this stream that comes out of this pressure cooker of the 19th century. We have a big event with America being established as a democracy. Not as a Christian nation, but with Christian Judeo underpinnings in terms of its laws and its freedom. It's really unprecedented in human history. And there's a lot of pressures that go into this thing. We have the theological pressures from Arminianism, Calvinism, the idea of personal freedom now, individual personal freedom, and rationalism, which is a threat to the Bible, and the new attractive kid on the block, majority rule, which is supposedly the panacea for all problems. You just have majority rule. And we have the threats from common sense, although it's not seen as the threat. It seems like an ally. We have scientific rules are coming into play that are never thought of before. The church owned them before, and now all of a sudden the science is outside the church, and now the science dictates to the church or dictates to the theologians truth. That's a whole new challenge, and that's part of what we get into with German rationalism, with the democratic government, and then we, of course, have America coming up. So out of that, we have these three streams. Next season, next fall, we'll be following more or less the brown upper layer. And we've been following the Calvinism, the middle layer with Calvinism and the covenantalist line, the conservative, you might almost say the believer line, although it's not always consistent. And tonight we're going to be following the Arminianism line, which leads to liberalism, amillennialism, which actually starts out as postmillennialism, and the liberal conservative split that will happen at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. So we're in a bottom branch tonight. Now, I put the Civil War over the issue. Civil War only lasted 4 years, 1861 to 1865, 4 years in there, and it was a horrendous event for everybody in America. It killed over 600,000 people, including a president who was assassinated as a result of the events of the war. So it's a huge thing, and it comes on top of Finney, and I think that is where our interest lies in the discussion. So pick up where we were last week. The shift to Arminianism was slow. I have my little diagram up there. We have Calvinism, we have Whitfield and Edwards. And then somewhere around middle of the 18th century, we have 1750 approximately in there. It starts shifting over to Arminianism and moralism, and that continues to grow and gets to get ahead of steam going, especially after the turn of the century. And you can see it turns into an Arminianism stream. Charles Finley becomes the dominant figure in the Second Awakening, as Edwards and Whitfield was in the first one. Might put Wesley in the first one. And we have, he was strong 1825, 1830 in his preaching, and then he went on to be a college president. And in a few years, we have the Civil War. And so his influence is strong there, and that's why we are going to talk about the Civil War. And how did we get into it? Well, we got into it through the avenue of moralism. So the shift to Arminianism was slow, but by the time of Finney's conversion in 1821, the shift was no longer opposed. No, if you don't remember how this goes, Arminianism is when man takes charge of all things, including his future, under the guise of God's magnificent blessings. So it's like God starts out, and it's like the power of steering. Once you start doing something, God will bless you. All right? So man takes in charge at this point. Now, and Arminianism is self-sufficient. If man does not truly fallen, and which means to say he has some good in him yet, then man does not need mercy, so it goes in grace. In Arminianism, man does not fall in his moral pursuits, fail in his moral pursuits. Now, that's always a little bit, you know, questionable, but, you know, in the overall pursuit, man really gets the job done. It really does. Since man assumes the role of sovereign, grace and mercy are theological concepts that are only loosely applied. You know, maybe like I said, after the fact, once you've made the decision what you're going to do, then God's grace can come on and bless what your efforts are. So Arminianism is man on his own, assisted by God when man is doing the right thing. So the opposite, I guess, all the way. So if man has the ability to determine his destiny, then he also has the responsibility to collectively change the moral condition of his culture. So if we all can have a decision in our destiny, then if we all get together, we'll all go together in the same way, in the same manner. So if man is perfectible, now with this assumption that we're in control of our moral life, he is therefore must be perfectible, he must be made perfect, then the society in which he lives can also be made perfect as well. Now, if you're wiping your brow over this already, you go ahead and do that, but that's the thinking here. So the theory goes there that there is righteousness in morality. And we questioned this with Finney. He said, well, how do the works expiate past sins? I mean, the works just take care of now, but what about the unworks you did yesterday? Finney never answered that question. He doesn't see an atonement in the death of Christ. It's all in the works. So man's goodness, moral goodness, is the essence of righteousness. Now, I should have put righteousness in quotes. Ergo, promoting the social good is producing righteousness. So that's how the connection is made. If I do a moral good, that's a righteous act, and God obviously considers that a moral, considers that a righteous act on my half, and counts it credited to my account. So Arminianism is when man takes control of life or his life. Man is free to do good, to promote the righteousness in culture for the community good. Man is free and able to arrive at perfection when applied to the citizens will produce a righteous society. So I have my little diagram here with the arrows, and it's, you know, you might say, well, it starts back with Christ and it ends over here when Christ returns. So we have this period of time. Now, we're not going to put Calvinism in here. The whole thing has been Arminian as far as they're concerned. So we have a song that expresses this. We don't sing in our church anymore. It's one of the things, it's one of the phrases in it says, when the darkness shall turn to dawning and the noon to noon, and the dawn to noon and bright. Thank you. So that's the idea that we're going to start with darkness and we're going to move to light. Well, that is postmillennialism. And we have at the end of this postmillennial period, Christ's great kingdom will come to earth, and then that kingdom will reign forth, I imagine, as they would say, then for eternity. All right. So that's my little diagram of how this works. Now, there is confusion. I remember when we had staff meetings some years ago, we got not into a food fight, but almost, about what postmillennialism is, and it was everybody against Gill. Now, I can't imagine who would win in that kind of case, but but it came down to a draw. Everybody sort of went away and said, okay. So I won't say who's on what side here, so that would be hard. But anyway, to me, postmillennialism, I guess I wouldn't give it away. I wonder if I said this to me. Postmillennialism says that it's going to get better. The darkness shall turn to dawning, and then the Lord will come. And it's always called postmillennialism. But in the other definition, the millennium doesn't really start until after the millennium is ended. So that's why it's so confusing. So I argued about that. So the postmillennialism really is, I think it is when Christ comes at the end of the millennium, although the millennium is not 1,000 years. It's been how many years since Christ? 2,000 years? So how can it be post-millennium? Millennial. So millennium is a flexible word. And if you get into these other theologies, they have a lot of flexible words. So what we're talking about here in this period of time, all the way back from Calvinism, all this whole time is post-millennial. We don't shake the postmillennialism until we get to the 20th century. We start a little before that, but you know that's when it starts to take hold. Premillennialism comes back to the fore. All right, so we're talking about postmillennialism, and in this time, man takes control of his life and his culture. And when they all do this in the aggregate, things are going to get better and better and better and better and better and better. That's why you know that if the person thinks that that's the way culture is, that he's postmillennial. If he says things are going to get worse and worse and worse and worse, he's not a premillennialist. He is a amillennialist. All right, we're not going to talk about amillennialism, but just for fun. So when society has reached its perfection, which is the time when Christ will return, because, you know, remember, this is how arrogant man is. Man has got the kingdom ready for the Lord to return. I think God comes to the world with his hat in hand and says, thank you, man, for doing this work for me. I couldn't have done it without you. And so God shows up to take over the kingdom. And that seems so silly to us. But when the society has reached its perfection, Jesus Christ, who has been waiting, hat in hand, returns to claim his creation, presented to him by his creatures in a post-millennial hope, who have been waiting for this post-millennial hope all along. Now, I always like to bring our hymns because they're interesting to me. This is that hymn. We have a story to tell to the nations, the name of the song. Is we've a story to tell to the nations that shall turn their hearts to the right, a story of truth and mercy, a story of peace and light, repeated. Then we have the refrain, for the darkness shall turn to dawning, the dawning to noonday bright, when Christ's great kingdom shall come on earth, a kingdom of love and light. Number two verse, I'm just going to do two of these. We have a song to be sung to the nations that lift their hearts to the Lord, a song that shall conquer evil and shatter the spear and the sword, and shatter the spear and the sword. Then we go back to the refrain again. The darkness shall turn to dawning, the dawning to noonday bright, and the Christ great kingdom shall come on earth, the kingdom of love and right. Very, very post-millennial. And you didn't have to be a Christian to believe this stuff. This is what everybody believed. So the theology of Christians was predominantly post-millennial. It's hard for us to grasp that a single theology would so grasp the minds of all the citizenry that virtually all, born-again or not born-again people, embrace this future event as a sure thing. All pointers were in that direction. Think of the newly planted Israel in the Promised Land, which is America. Well, that's us, you remember. It was too good to be true. It was too good to be denied. During this time, many even set dates for the coming of the Lord. Even Finney said, "Well, I think in 1835, he thought the Lord would come in 3 years." And we have William Miller, who was the forerunners of the Seventh-day Adventist. He set the date, I think, 1843 or something like that. Then others that set dates too, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons, they've all been date setters. And if you remember the word for those kind of people, anybody remember the word for those kind of people is? Anybody? Anybody? Historicist. Now, do you remember? If they're setting dates, they're historicists. I mean, hands down. So these are all historicists. They look at the Bible and look for history in the Bible that was appearing before their very eyes. So Finney, what damage has he caused? I just got to say, wow, and whatever. So Finney is armed with dangerous weapons. First of all, he's got an Arminian argument, which everybody loves. I'm in my own man type thing. I like the idea that I would be perfect, that I can actually do that, ideal of man. And if I can be perfect, you can be perfect, and we join together and have a perfected society. Isn't that wonderful? And when this is all done, with this great hope, in a post-millennial sense, the Lord will return and the kingdom will continue or be started. Now, those are great things. Now, what he has is this great personality, apparently, and a great energizer using these ideas to energize moralism. Okay? So, with these hopes and these ideas, the moralism just flourishes. Because moralism, again, goes back to human ability. All of these, Arminianism, perfectionism, and the society perfected, and getting the society ready for the Lord's return is all out of human effort. So these energize the morals of men. And these are the days, in these days of the revival that led America into a civil war. The result is over 600,000 American deaths in a war that was the product of moralism. Go on to seed. So we're going to do the bottom, but I talked to you about that already. It's a liberal branch in the second half of the 19th century. Now we're going to spend a little time on moralism. I don't know if if we think of moralism, whether anything comes to your mind or not. But there are people that are moralists, and you recognize them, and you know how they promote their goodness all the time. It's something that is on the top of the burner, and it's the first thing to talk about, it's the last thing to talk about when you leave, all right? So this moralism is out there. In fact, all unbelievers are moralists. You know, some of them hide it better than others do. Some are really open about what they can do and how good they are about things, and no one else can get away with anything. My kids especially, I mean, I've gotten ruled with iron hand. That's me. They obey just like a moralism. All right. Now, last week, I went home really depressed because I brought you some words from a guy named Norton, Michael Norton. I said, I'm never going to do that again. Because when you bring a guy like Michael Norton to the table, you got to explain where he's wrong when you're using him as a quote. I'll never do that again until next week. So I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it again. I'm just going to probably really be mad at myself for doing this, but I got to do this. Moralism. Al Mohler. Anybody know who Al Mohler is? One Southern Baptist, powerful, powerful speaker. I've listened to stuff. He's great. And the Word of God, I mean, just great. Southern Baptist guy. John MacArthur has him at his place all the time. So anyway, this guy ought to be good on moralism. All right, so he says, and I'm going to try to keep you steady with what he says. Al Mohler says, the seduction of moralism, God, the seduction of moralism, the trickery of moralism is the essence of its power. You're going to be tricked into moralism. We are so easily seduced into believing that we actually can gain all the approval we need by our behavior. Does that not describe your unbelieving friends? You're going to get approval by your behavior. When you depend on your behavior to make things right with the Lord, that is moralism. L. Moeller, of course, in order to participate in this seduction, we must negotiate a moral code that defies acceptable behavior with innumerable loopholes. Most moralists would not claim to be without sin, but merely beyond scandal. That should be sufficient. Now, already he's opening a door to something. You notice this? Of course, in order to participate in the seduction, we must negotiate a moral code. A moral code that defines acceptable ability or acceptable behavior. And then he says, and these people that do this, they make these loopholes to get out of their code. They just set up for themselves, like to create a God that they can live with, that kind of thing. So they say that the moralists, you know, set up this goal. All right. Now, moralists don't say they're without sin. They just say they're not so sinful. They're not so sinful, they're disqualified. They're sinful, but not that much. You know, so they have this lower level of acceptance. Now, remember, Finney insisted on keeping the law. Now, I'm going back here. We already have to negotiate a moral code in L. Moeller's speech. Finney said he insisted on keeping the law, but never addressed the problem of broken laws. So as we said, his standard was not to worry about the past unless it raised to the level of a scandal. Remember with the halfway measures guy. It'll come to me in a minute here. But he changed the rules of the church so that as long as their moral life wasn't a scandal, they could be a church member. Stoddard. Stoddard was the name. Okay, so he changed the rules on the church. So as long as it wasn't a scandal, then you couldn't question their salvation. All right. Now, this is true of baptized believers in Stoddard's day. So as long as they did not betray themselves by too bad a behavior, were considered saved. Kind of a sidebar. We're still with moralism. But now we have confusion at the highest level of Christianity. Why? This is L. Moeller's paper now. I'll pick a little piece out and I'm going to go through it. Why moralism is not the gospel. Agree with that. And why so many Christians think it is, that moralism is the gospel. It's not, he says. So now the danger is that the church will communicate by both direct and indirect means that what God expects of fallen humanity is moral improvement. That's good. Because you're going to not have people think that all you got to do is morally improve yourself. That the church can make a mistake and give that impression. Moeller says on the law, Christians understand that God has revealed himself throughout creation in such a way that he has gifted all humanity with the restraining power of the law. He just stepped off the curb. The restraining power of the law. So now we're going to put the law back into place. We just got through saying you don't want to put the law in because it's going to confuse people. But now he says we've been gifted with, all humanity has been gifted with the restraining power of the law. Furthermore, he has spoken to us in his word in the gift of his specific commandments and comprehensive moral instruction. That's the law that he just, you know, ridiculed. So the faithful church and Lord Jesus Christ must contend for righteousness of these commands, these laws, and the grace given to us in the knowledge of what is good and what is evil. Those are the laws. He's preaching law to me. We also have the responsibility to bear witness of this knowledge of good and evil to our neighbors. I'm preaching the law to my neighbors now. The restraining power of the law is essential to human community and to civilization. Restraining power of the law is essential. I have to preach the law to everybody. Just what I started out, we can't do because it's going to be confusing to the people. And he's doing it. That's why I brought this to you. Just as parents rightly teach their children to obey moral instruction, the church also bears responsibility to teach its own moral commandments of God and bear witness to the larger society and what God has declared to be right and good for his human creatures. That's law preaching, which he said you don't want to do to people because it confuses them. Turns right around or does it? But these impulses, right, necessary as they are, he says, are not the gospel. That's true. Indeed, one of the most insidious false gospel is moralism, which he just talked about. You're going to preach the gospel to people. They're going to think they need to obey it. That's moralism. A moralism that promises the favor of God and the satisfaction of God's righteousness to sinners. if they will only behave and commit themselves to moral improvement. I'm not saying he's saying that, but when you preach the law to people, that's what they're going to think. So I say, I'm Ed, you know, if you tell your neighbor or church, if you tell your neighbor or your church teaches the law to be obeyed, why would he not conclude that righteousness comes by the law? I mean, if I'm going to teach, you've got to keep the law. And every time I meet him, so you got to keep the law. Why is he not going to think he's going to have to keep the law to be righteous? Now, this flaw is not far from us. We saw it in Dallas, Texas, December 2017. We were preached the law. We were told that we needed to keep the law. Part of this was that Christ kept the law for us, and the righteousness gained is imputed to us as believers. Christ kept the law. We have to keep the law. We can't do it. Christ kept it for us. The law keeping is imputed to us. We talked about that. What do you call that? The passive obedience of Christ, or the active obedience of Christ. Now, be fair, they would say that the law needs to be preached so that those who obey its preaching will find that they cannot keep the law, that sounds biblical, and then look for the Savior, that sounds biblical, who then can save without the law. But for me, this is quite a maze of network to negotiate for a blinded soul, isn't it not? This formula is appropriate for Israel, who was under the law, but the lesson has already been brought to bear on Israel once. There's no need to retest the theory on the church. Paul says very clearly in Galatians, you are not under law, then how can anyone preach it? Anyway, where Moeller started, he said, the danger is that the church will communicate by both direct and indirect means that what God expects of fallen humanity is moral improvement. And I just think he went through a series of statements that says you have to have moral improvement. He doesn't mean it, I'm sure, but that's how it's going to come across when you preach the law. When they preach the law, have they not fallen into moralism? And that's why we don't preach the law here. Okay. Now, I feel good right now, but I mean, I feel good later. So moralism is alive and well. That's why I did this. Sometimes we think, well, this is back in the 19th century, long time ago, moral. No, it's right under our noses here. So moralism is alive and well, even in the most conservative churches. We spent some time explaining that even in our present day, covenantalism's preaching of the law teaches moralism. It takes a nuanced explanation to undo the effect of preaching the law. Well, I know we preach the law, but you got to, and just a nuanced explanation. You just don't do it. So when we talk about moralism in the 19th century, we ought not to disassociate it from our present day challenges. So whenever you sit in a church, you're visiting somewhere, you won't hear it here, and you're sitting in a church and they're telling you got to keep the law, you know you're being fed something that's wrong. That doesn't mean you can't be moral. You better be moral. You better not do sinful things. That's a different thing. We'll talk about what moralism is and what being moral is. I've not finished this book yet, but I think I can recommend about halfway through it. Don't know if the guy's a believer or not, but it's on this issue of moralism in the section before the anti-war period up through about 1870. And he calls the moral reconstruction. A lot of times we talk about the war, and then there was a reconstruction after the war, which had a lot to do with reconstructing the nation. You know, there's all this dying and all this carnage and the ruin, and, you know, we just call it reconstruction. But he applies that word to the moral reconstruction, which is really interesting how this works out. And this was the surprise for me, how that there is this moral reconstructing that goes on, that comes through the Civil War and goes on after the Civil War. So this is a book by a Christian lobbyist and federal legislation of morality, Gaines Foster. I always thought it'd been fun if I'd been named somebody else than Donald, you know, something like Gaines. I mean, some of these names, just Dalimore, you know, just really got some good, you know, rich texture to them, but no, but I do have a namesake down in the White House, so I guess it's okay. But I was a Donald before he was, so. Okay, so the antebellum, anti-war period, which is before the Civil War. We begin our discussion with the same layering issue we've always faced when discussing history. And layer, different kind of categories of Christians, I'm called categories of Christians, you know, all the way from, you know, liberal, you know, to Unitarians, way up to, you know, born-again believers, what? So there's all kinds in between. And as we've done before, we're not going to be able to differentiate. So as born-again Christians, we have a clear line of separation between those who are and those who are not saved. The demarcation is clear, which goes to help explain various behaviors. However, historical authors, nearly all of them, do not give us this perspective unless in a footnote somewhere they might say what their faith is. So they don't give us this perspective on culture or their belief system, nor is it ever clear what's in the heart of the men they're writing about. Therefore, we're left largely with generalities, thus inaccuracies, perhaps, and a few distinctions between the true and believer behaviors and those who may be only professing believers. So we're going to deal with them as we always do as a group. So in the period of 1800 to 1900, we have a wide range, ranging Christian scale, a mix of people who do not believe the same thing or act in the same consistent way. It must then also be remembered that when we talk about the 19th century as the time when Arminianism gains ground, there remain many Calvinists, but they were no longer influential. By the same standard, we describe the period as one of moralism. That does not mean that all Christians subscribe to it or in the same way. As we just saw Moeller speak against moralism, and the next paragraph promotes keeping the law, clearly a moralistic activity. So even the sighted can be blinded to some truth, as those denying historical Israel make grave mistakes in other parts of theology, just the case of Moeller. So we always have to be alert. So our approach will be that we will consider all of the 19th century Christians, believers, or so until a uniquely identifiable group emerges. The divergence becomes apparent when conflict breaks out within the denominational church. And this is going to show up between 1875 and 1925, those 50 years. By the time you get to 1940, while all the sides are pretty well settled. For our study, this happens after in the U.S. after the Civil War. Then by the turn of the century, the die is cast and the division by the Christians coming out become irreversible. That'll be our next year's lesson. Now, I want to try one more attempt at this moralism thing. I took it off the line, so this is not much of my work. And since it's not my work, it's got to be better. So something is moral, it's got to be something good. Quotes, good. Moral can never be bad, right? It's still going to get moral and good goes together, whatever goodness means. So, but this goodness must have a constant reference. It's just good without a reference. He's a good father means he's referred to other fathers, which are better. You know, and this one is better than all the others. So he's a good father. We see that the constant unchanging referent is God in the issue of moral goodness. God is the standard of good. What he does is good. We don't judge to see if he's doing good. What he does is good. So he is the standard. God says what is good. Of course, we are not under the Mosaic law, but the elements of goodness are found there in the treatment of others. Now, I'm not going to put you under the Mosaic law. I'm not going to do a molar on you. But there are certain things that are true in the Mosaic law that is recognized in Scripture, which is property rights, the honor of people, the truthfulness in relationships. These are moral acts that are connected to our love for others. You don't defraud somebody by telling him a lie. The consideration of the brother is not to defraud him. So actions that are moral then are not defrauding another person. The actions that are moral do not necessarily imply moralism, which is a totally different thing. Moralism implies that personal righteousness is gained by moral acts, a works righteousness. However, moralism may not subscribe to the moral standards of God's goodness. Moralism depends on the standard you're looking at. Sometimes you make up your own, we said, and then you make loopholes in it so it fits your lifestyle. However, moralism may not subscribe to the moral standard of God's goodness, but likely to a false, attainable, and flexible standard. You got to be careful here so that you don't get yourself in a corner here and make laws you can't keep. So make it low enough that you can keep and claim that no one else can. That's moralism. So likely false, attainable, and flexible standard that will not condemn the moralist. When the moralist seeks to impose the standards on righteousness of others, moralism has produced its fruit, which is where it's going. Why does it make somebody else, who's better, me or he, me or him? So moralism is constantly defined as the practice of morality as distinct from religion. You can be a moralist but not be religious. A non-religious person who nonetheless lives by a personal moral code can be said to hold to moralism. Another more negative definition of moralism is an undue emphasis on morality. I would never. You know, you sort of put this up there. Whatever it would be that you would never do. In this case, the moralist would be seen as a prude, a self-righteous prig, or an utterly austere moral snob. I didn't make that up. So religious moralism is an emphasis on proper moral behavior. Now, this is a religious kind. Moral behavior to the exclusion of genuine faith. So this would be a person that goes to church but is not saved. So he can be a moralist. Religious moralism and legalism are similar but differ slightly in that legalism usually refers to a doctrinal position. Now, we get into religion here. Legalism regards to a doctrinal position, emphasizing a system of rules and regulations, often the New Testament laws, for achieving salvation and spiritual growth. So churches, people in churches are usually called legalists. They don't usually call those people that belong to the Elks Club and do something wrong legalists. So the church has a standard. Usually they assume it's the Old Testament or whatever, or the Bible, and they're held to that standard and promote it legalistic. That's what I think almost Al Moore is doing with his preaching the law to the people. Now, Paul warned against legalism in Galatians chapter 3. Moralism doesn't necessarily point to any established system, the secular moralism. The moralist is free to concoct his own set of rules and regulations, usually the ones he has no trouble keeping, enabling him to feel good about adhering to them. Christian moralism focuses on moral behavior, such as an extent that obedience comes before faith and the grace is often obscured. So in practice, moralism begins to look a lot like legalism, but that only happens in the church or religious context. Christian moralists tend to reduce the Bible to a manual for moral behavior, often centering on such passages as the Sermon on the Mount and the Ten Commandments. And if you've been around liberal people, they'll always quote the Sermon on the Mount, as I said, to the point where they say, you know, you can throw the rest of the Bible away, just give me the Sermon on the Mount, because that's all they ever refer to. And it's flexible enough, because they don't say what it really means anyway, but they go to these passages and say the morality of these passages determine your whole faith. So that's what you got to obey. So the moralist relies on his moral actions. If he prays, goes to church, helps his community, then he is good with God. That makes him a moralist. Moralism says you don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal, you don't cuss too much, not too much, and then you are a good person and deserving heaven. But the moralist is self-deceived in thinking that his good behavior sometimes merits eternal life. He is very, very self-deceived. And I say, once the moralism heads its nose in the tent, it will enter it entirely. The idea that man chooses righteousness makes it easy for him to choose all the other righteous acts too along the way to perfection. Nothing to stop him. So the motivation of righteousness acts spring from two sources, two places, two motivations, two levels or sources. And I'm going to take a drink. I've just put this up because we're in this section where moralism is going to reign supreme and it leads us into the Civil War. So questioning of slavery erupts into the open with the preaching of Finney. When all else fails, try humor, says one guy. Says, well, self-righteousness is better than no righteousness, isn't it, after all? Okay, now slavery as a moral issue. In fact, today it's the moral issue of moral issues. But I say it is only so in modern times. So we have two levels, two sources of this moralism. First of all, the idea of morality based on the idea that certain ideas are or activities are, the word here is sin. Sinful. Immoral things are sinful things. On the other side, we have the idea of morality is based on the idea of justice and equality. Sin doesn't enter into it. One side, it's a morality based on God's standards. The other basis is the morality that is based on humanistic standards. We could take a vote on the humanistic standards. Well, how much morality should a person have? You know, you vote on that. So it's a flexible standard. Well, when it comes to God's standard of morality, it's not flexible. Remember, it's a solid standard. So this, we keep the same comparison here. The Bible is the authority. Here, slavery, in the Bible sense now, is sinful. But no concern about the injustice. It's just sinful. Perceived and the injustice. Perceived and the freedom denied or lost on the slaves. It's not worried about that. They just say, it's a sinful act. Yeah, stop the sinful act. There's no worry about the next step or what else is left. Because it's a sinful act. What do you do with sin? You stop doing it, right? So the ending status of a freed slave is less of a lesser concern than the sin committed against him. And if we'd be a good Calvinist back here, we'd say, and God will take care of the rest. Your obligation is to stop the sinning. Okay, so this has to do with our personal ethic. It has to do with our personal righteousness. You can't be sinning and doing these things if you're coming from this standpoint. Remember, we're starting with two places. Two places where we start from. The Bible is authority is one. Now we're going to go to the human, the basic of humanism. The idea is that being sinful is not as powerful as the inequality produced by slavery. Because on one side we have a standard that God sets up. On the other side we have a flexible standard. You know? So eliminating slavery is not the end. Because until a slave is elevated to a status of equality, the social work isn't done yet. See, but if it's a sinful act, he's done when he quits doing this slavery, sets the slaves free. On the humanist side, it isn't enough just to set him free. He's got to be brought up to equality. Now, I never know what equality exactly is. So in this sense, we have a social ethic against a personal ethic. We have personal righteousness against a social righteousness. Am I doing that right for you? Whatever. I'm doing it right for me. You got to flip over. All right, so just get that kind of in your head. I thought that's probably the best thing I got when I started reading the book, that he made this distinction. You know, that if you're going to use the Bible's authority, then the issue is sin. If you don't use the Bible's authority, then what is it? Humanism. And humanism is not very reliable. And it has extra stuff packed into it that you don't have with the Bible authority. You know, the Bible authority just says release the slaves. But in humanist side, not only release the slaves, you've got to make them good. And whatever that means, because how many generations has this been going on? You've got to make all that good. I mean, perhaps. Okay. Enter the Second Great Awakening. Radical abolitionists, if I say abortionists here, I don't mean that. I mean abolitionists, were partly fueled by the religious, not necessarily born again, Christian fervor, of the Second Awakening, which prompted many people to advocate for emancipation on religious grounds, not necessarily believers. Now, we have religious moral grounds, but not necessarily depending on the Bible. They can be, quote, Christians, believers, moralists, depending on humanism, because it does get mixed up here. Gets confusing. Now, a little bit about slavery. Don't want to take too much time here. So I only have 15 minutes left. I don't know how I'm going to do this. Slavery can be traced back to the earliest records, such as the Mesopotamian Code of Hammurabi, 1860 BC, which referred to it as an established institution and was common among ancient people. Now, slavery was a social construct that functioned for good or for ill for millenniums. While the Enlightenment thinkers mixing their optimism with post-millennialism, post-millennial theologians construct only the bad of slavery. Never talk about the good of slavery. You say, well, there's no good. Well, see, there are some good things you can say about slavery. That's where I'm going to get in trouble. I say stuff like that. So they never say anything about, they always say things about the bad, but they never say anything about the slavery itself. I should read this for you rather than try to tell you what it says. Well, the Enlightenment thinkers mixing their optimism with post-millennial theologians construct only the bad, the abuses of slavery. Well, that seems true, but we find Onesimus, a slave in the Bible, carrying on a satisfying life as a believer. Slavery was known in the very first civilizations, that's Sumer in Mesopotamia, days back 3500, which is the wrong date, didn't go back that far, frankly, as well as almost every other civilization. The Byzantine-Ottoman Wars and the Ottoman Wars in Europe, which ended in 1517, remember the war, wars of Europe, resulted in the taking of large numbers of Christian slaves, especially amongst the Slavic, which is Russian, people of Central and Eastern Europe. Slavery's been around a long time. Slavery became the common, became common within much of Europe during the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, as they call it. The Dutch, the French, the Spanish, Portuguese, British, Arabs, and a number of West African kingdoms played a prominent role in the Atlantic slave trade, especially after 1600. Remember, John Newton was a captain, and he writes the song, and he gets saved through all this. Remember that? Know that story about him? Amazing Grace guy. There were horrendous abuses of slavery and trade that supported the practice, but abuses must all be separated out of an issue. Some parents beat their children, right? I've heard that. Does that mean parents should not be outlawed to have children? No, you can be able to separate those things out. The abolition movement began in England out of Christian roots. Christian roots. Born-again Christian roots. Wilbert Wilberforce probably was a born-again believer. A member of the House of Commons became intricately involved in the abolition of slave trade in Britain. His conversion to evangelical Christianity in 1784, and he almost right away took up the cause as a new believer, which is interesting to me. His conversion to evangelical Christianity in 1784 plays a key role in interesting him in the social reform. This may or may not be moralism on his part. I don't know. Only the heart can tell. Social concerns for slaves certainly is honorable. What he does privately may be worthy. If slavery needs to be abolished to prepare for the Messiah, that may be considered moralism. So it's hard to tell. By the way, Britain abolished slavery in 1833. Others, English Quakers, evangelical, condemned slavery as unchristian. Now, I might say in my little asterisk there, this is not an easily accomplished thing. That was an anti-Christian thing. The Bible makes no direct statements about the morality of slavery. Again, Arminianism has no problem adding ideas to Scripture. They're not as bound to the Scripture, so they can be somewhat more flexible. So at that time, most slaves were Africans, but thousands of Native Americans were also enslaved. In the 18th century, as many as 6 million Africans were transported to the Americas as slaves, at least a third of them on British ships to North America. Abolition was part of the message of Quakers, who they were moralists, you know. The Great Awakenings of the 1730s, 1740s in the 13 colonies with Edwards and Whitfield were not abolitionists because, again, they were Calvinists. Calvinists were not abolitionists because the sin forgiven of slavery left the freed slave on his own in God's care. That's how they saw it, I'm sure. Remember that humanism says, no, now we got to take care of them. Now we got reparations to, you know, build them back. You know, well, that may be okay. But, becomes an obligation in the system. All right, Edwards and Whitfield were not abolitionists, whereas Arminian John Wesley was. And we'll meet a guy here in a minute. I'll mention him to you because when he went to Georgia, he met the guy that was an anti-slavery guy in Georgia. And I have an idea that's where he picked up this idea. Remember, John and Charles Wesley went over there first time to Georgia to work on this, you know, he ostensibly finally goes to a children's home. And Charles Wesley comes back because he didn't get along with this Oldsworth, whatever his name is, I'll show you in a minute. So anyway, that's where this Arminianism with the abolitionists probably came from, although I can't say that for sure. All right, so these are the descendants of the first Great Awakening. In the same period, rational thinkers of the Enlightenment, now we're talking about like in France, the Enlightenment without God, criticized slavery for violating human rights. Remember, the French Revolution was to gain human rights, get away from the king and the queen. The way you do that, you cut their heads off. That is a long way to get into your freedoms. So, founder of the Providence of Georgia, here we have Oglethorpe, I just mentioned to you, and where Wesley's worked under him, banned slavery on humanistic grounds, not on religious grounds. He argued against the Parliament and eventually encouraged his friends, Granville Sharp. Now, that's the name you maybe remember. It's a Greek. And Hannah More to vigorously pursue the cause. Granville Sharp, Gil has referred to that. It has to do with rule and grammar. Let's see how this goes. If the noun or the verb, whichever it is given first, and then there are two, if this is a verb and two nouns, I think it's the other way around. This noun and two verbs. If this noun is given, the Granville Sharp rules that this noun refers to both of these. Not in their and, but they're not in connection. They're both separate. So that's the Granville Sharp rule. Anyway, so I thought, well, interesting. That name comes up here. So he's probably a believer, you know, at least a scholar in the Bible, a Greek. Well, soon after their death, 1875, Sharp and Moore joined with Wilberforce and others to form this Chapin sect, which is abolitionists. As you said, the Christians and the Enlightenment thinkers found common ground in moral issues. Just like the American Revolution people, Christians found moral ground with the common sense people. You know, it's a very dangerous thing to be in. We went through that with common ground with the Bible and psychology. You know, that this sort of thing is what's going on here. The Christians were not directed by the biblical text. They adopted moral ideas from freedom of Christ, that's flexibleness, and they applied that now, which translates into a freedom for all in this world as God's plan for everybody, because we're free in Christ, therefore everybody should be free, go into the political arena. Now, it is now, when they did that, now it is a moral issue. If God has commanded it and he made this nuanced understanding of our freedom now applied to every political situation, now it becomes a moral issue supported by all, especially the humanists, all who promote abolition. All these are moralists based on a loose idea of biblical truth, or were humanists, moralists who believe in an equality for everyone. It didn't matter why, as long as you're against slavery, you're an abolitionist, you could do common cause. Well, anyway, this is just kind of to show you that Wilberforce started back here very small, and it grew, and I called it Christianizing America. And eventually, when you get over here, we have a moralized America, or I call it up here Christianized. Christianization of the world, America, is completed, and that's where the split starts to occur, because the real born-again people are not going along with this anymore. And then we have at the bottom here the secular humanist. Then we start with the French Revolution. I'm not sure where this started. Probably much earlier than that, because Erasmus and Luther time was a humanist. So back here somewhere. Anyway, this line comes along, and then they join the forces here in the Civil War, and both become abolitionists. So this group, all these groups form the basis for why the war was fought. Now, during and immediately following the American Revolution, northern states, beginning with Pennsylvania, 1780, passed legislation during the next 2 days, abolishing slavery, sometimes by gradual anticipation. Now, remember, this argument is not a new one, but how do you get rid of slavery? If you cut it all head off, everybody that owns slaves, they're bankrupt. You know, some of these northern states actually paid money so these slaves could be released. Because, you know, it's like you guys that are farmers and all your machinery taken from you. You know, well, they were the slaves. They were your machinery. And they were taken from you and, well, they were gone. So there was in the north consideration for people that were trying to get out of this thing, knowing that that's where it was going. And so there was some provisions for that. So Massachusetts ratified a constitution that declared all men equal. Freedom suits challenging slavery based on the principle brought an end to slavery in the state, although it wasn't always evenly applied against Africans who were slaves, or had been slaves. So I call the death of slavery is already in process. During the ensuing decades, the abolitionist movement grew in northern states, and Congress regulated the expansion of slavery at new states were admitted to the Union. When was Nebraska made a state? What year? 1867. We had a battle of numbers here before, and I lost every one of them. So this was after the Civil War. It was after the Civil War. Okay, you just got to remember that. So Nebraska really was not a state during the Civil War, and it never was in the South, and it never had slavery. All right? But Kansas, being a border state, there were some. John Brown came from Kansas. All right? So he was a prohibitionist, absolutist. All right, so Congress regulated expansion in these new territories. Britain banned the importation of African slaves. I'm going to go a little faster here. Closer attention to Finley's theology and the anti-slave activities reveals not only a firm commitment to abolitionism, but also a conviction that Christian indifference to slavery impeded the great work of spreading the gospel. Far from being mutually exclusive enterprises, the progress of revivals and the abolition of slavery formed part of the same process by which men hastened the onset of the millennium. Now, you see where the pressure now is in coming from Finney. He's preaching abolition, and if abolition doesn't occur, the Lord won't come. That is inflaming, inciting people. So regarding slaveholders as a threat to the benevolent man's pursuit of holiness, Charles Finney marked down the destruction of the slave system as a major prerequisite for the coming of the millennium. And if you preach that way, that incites things. So the notion of triumph over sin is crucial in the doctrine of perfectionism formulated by the great revivalist Charles Finney. Christians learned that they could conquer sin, the drunkard could stop drinking, the adulterer could become faithful, the slaveholder could free his slaves, the Christian could stop urging the name of the Lord in vain, could observe the Sabbath, could be truthful, could, in short, obey God's commandments. In this notion of conquest provided an enormous energy to the converted. They could remake themselves, and since society was simply a collection of individuals, they could remake it as well. Evangelicals were reformers by definition. Reform meant eradicating sin, the sin of intemperance. Now we go on this list of things that are going to come. This is what I'll probably deal with next week. The sin of intemperance, sin of slavery, the violation of the Sabbath, prostitution, gaming, and so on. And by the way, did you know there was a law that they finally had to pass to quit delivering mail on Sunday? Did you know that you didn't get mail on Sunday? You ever wonder why not? What's Sunday? Well, where'd that come from? All right. So for wherever there was sin, there were sinners who were responsible for the evil that was wrought. So finally, or Finney, shared the widespread hope and expectation that the millennium was just around the corner, announced in 1835, that it might occur within 3 years. He was greatly encouraged by the number of conversions that took place in another great revival just before the outbreak of the Civil War. There are historians who believe that it was Finney who single-handedly caused the Civil War. Now, a plausible conclusion, as the end product of his preaching, was moral reform and not a new birth. No one is more dangerous than a moral reformer on fire, followed by an unthinking population. And I just have to ask you to watch Joel Osteen. Again, we hear the strains of the battle hymn of the Republic with the phrase, "Our God is marching on, glory, glory, hallelujah, glory, glory, hallelujah," a post-millennial text. Well, he reported that as many as 50,000 converts had occurred in a single week. This is Finney, but added on a more somber note that the revival lost steam as it headed to the South. And I say perhaps an abolitionist message did not preach well in the South. Well, Perry Miller is one of the great, not a believer type historian, but he's cited a lot. He says this about the Civil War. "One can almost say that the steady burning of the revivals, sometimes smoldering, now blazing into flame, never quite extinguished, even in Boston, until the Civil War had been fought, was a central mode of this cultural search for a national identity. And it had to have a moral identity. And you can't have a moral identity with slavery." So trying to keep the motion out of our discussion, the issue of federalism certainly was on the issue in the newly formed United States, that the federal government was getting too big, or the arms are out too far. There was a fear that the states would lose control of their territories to a federal government, a real and eminently real danger. In the North, slavery was being abandoned over a period of time, which minimized the shock to the economy. The solution would have liberated the slaves in the South as well, a slower changeover. The South had grown dependent on slave working fields. We know that. It said they were our tractors, the machinery. You know, you just can't throw them away and have anything. Somehow they got to work yourself out of that. It would take some time to make the transition to hired workers, but it was possible, as history has shown, partly within the Industrial Revolution, replacing manpower with steam power. Well, with the danger federalism posed, that morality laws would be wrenched from the states, with the states losing their independence. And it's interesting to me, talk about this next week, it is interesting how many laws that are moral laws today are federal laws. It comes out of this period. It's a reconstruction of moralism. Okay? So it has been argued that states' rights were just deployed to keep slavery intact. I'm not sure that may be true. It may be provable. However, the states' rights argument has borne out. For as soon as the federal government by a war against the South outlawed slavery, it was only a short time before other moral issues were raised to the federal level. Issues of temperance, polygamy, sexual issues, divorce, pornography, mail delivery, Sunday's closing, gambling, prize fighting, child labor, suffrage, all became federal laws. And we didn't think anything of it. But if you thought the state should govern that, can you imagine the problem you have with this infringement? So while abolition may have started with the born-again Christian Wilberforce in England, it soon found common cause with Enlightenment thinkers who influenced American preachers like Findlay, who became an active agent to foment civil war. He even feared such, but felt it was worth it for the moral good. Immoral good, perhaps, but was the Civil War the only way? Was it worth the price of over 600,000 people? And I have a chart over here of people that died in these battles. Gettysburg's got 51,000 in one battle. 51,000? That's the fourth of Lincoln. That's a lot of people. Roughly 1.2 million American soldiers have died in the nation's war. 620 in the Civil War, 644 in other conflicts. It was only recently that the Vietnam War, that the amount of American deaths in foreign wars eclipsed the number who died in the Civil War. We ask again, was it worth it? Family members split on opposite sides of the front, friends and brothers killing friends and brothers. You know the story. Well, for what? The likelihood was that slavery would have died out in a Christianized culture. It was on its way out. It couldn't have sustained the economic, propelled by economic benefits of a freed society, was almost 100% certain it would happen in the North. Why would it not happen in the South? And it would have come to us with industrialized revolution anyway, which is just a few decades away. So, would it not be an irony of ironies that the Christianized moralists are responsible for the carnage? What lessons have we learned when the church does not stay at home? Last week's lesson. What lessons do we learn when the church does not stay at home, when it becomes embroiled in a moral war out there? A moral war is an oxymoron, I guess. What mockery that those who purport to promote the greatest benefit or influence on morals are guilty of one of the greatest crimes against humanity, a civil war amongst its fellow citizens. Was the war worth the gain to say 10 or 50 years? Hardly. Well, anyway, as I showed you, federalism is here to stay. The leaders of the most reform efforts from the Northeast to the Midwest and Protestants were more willing than ever to expand the government's influence over the issues other than slavery. And I just listed those for you. And it says here, go west, young man, go west. The American destiny.